There is no free lunch when it comes to investing, but what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to The Free Lunch, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to The Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin.
Oh, nice to hear that again.
Yeah, this is your second or third episode back.
Yeah, yep.
And it just feels good to say that, actually.
Yeah, no, it's a comfortable place. You know, we did 230 podcasts together previously, so
232. But who's counting?
Okay, but who's counting? Yeah,
yeah.
But it's nice to be back in the chair.
Yeah, yeah, and not all those podcasts, unfortunately, are still available for distribution.
Right,
but it does mean that we have the opportunity to record another 230 episodes going forward.
Fantastic.
Together.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we'll never lose. You know what's funny, Greg, is I've had people say, don't you ever run out of things to talk about?
Yeah.
You know, because we are recording like 51 or 52 episodes a year.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
But given all the headlines and what's around us, the answer is no.
No, there's always so much going on. And in this business, as we've talked many times, what's going on, it's important. It's, you know, I've always said it's important to understand what's going on and to know what's going on. It doesn't mean that it's going to inform every investment decision you make. In fact, you hope that what's going on doesn't dramatically change your investment strategy.
Yeah.
But you certainly want to be aware of it.
Yeah.
Just being humans living on this earth, you know, there's a lot going on that affects us. So
for sure. Yeah. Oh, and I should mention, we were talking before we started recording. So you are not licensed anymore.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. Which was the first in 20, how many years?
Yeah. What was it? 28 years?
Let's call it three decades.
Close enough. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So everything that we're talking about is, you're not giving investment advice.
Not at all.
We're just talking about investments in general.
Yeah. I mean, this podcast is always meant to be educational and hopefully interesting and maybe fun from time to time.
Yeah.
Hopefully regularly. But no, and as we've said, you know, for the first 232 episodes we did together, I mean, investment advice, you know, is something that comes from your investment advisor when you sit down with them and mm-hmm. go through your plan and everything that needs to be known about your situation is known and understood. And it's something you work on together.
Yeah.
Listening to a podcast, any podcast, whether it's this or dozens, hundreds of other podcasts, is strictly for educational purposes or for entertainment, interest.
Well, the barrier of entry to launch a podcast is pretty low.
That's right.
I mean, we did it.
Well, you need to buy a couple of microphones,
yeah.
Some headphones, and this thing. What is this Rodecaster Pro?
Are you recommending certain products?
Well, I don't, why not? What the hell?
It's actually a great product. Yeah,
it is.
Rodecaster Pro.
For anybody thinking of starting a podcast, look at the Rodecaster Pro. Available now.
Well, let's talk about products and services and just reflect on the last three decades.
Sure.
So when you started your journey as a newly minted investment advisor at a bank-owned brokerage firm,
mm-hmm.
30 some odd years ago almost 30 years ago, there are certain products that were around you.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what was available to investors back then?
Sure. When I started, so, and you went through this as well at the firm I started with, we were sent, all of us new advisors were sent on a training program to Toronto, which at that time was a 2-month program. And over the time, they brought in all of the support services, the people in the advisory capacity in Toronto that were responsible for analyzing stocks. So the research analysts, the bond traders, you know, financial planners, you know, people like that. And so they basically paraded these people around us so we could understand what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was, of course, you know, you'd have all the equity analysts, stock researchers that would, you know, sort of come in and they would give their background of the sectors that they covered, whether they were covering banking or finance or commodities, you know, things like that. So they would talk a little bit about the sector that they covered, and then they'd talk about some of their top picks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, it's very exciting when a research analyst says, okay, well, this particular company, it's our top pick. We think the upside target, you know, price would be double where it's trading today. And you get all excited about that, of course.
Because they're talking about like double in like 12 months.
That's right. They would have a 1-year target price. And then there was also, because mutual funds were also a big part of the investment landscape back then, as they are now, we would have analysts that, you know, covered mutual funds, or they would bring in fund managers from the different fund companies or wholesalers, people that basically are the intermediaries between the managers and investment advisors, to talk about their funds and why you should buy their funds. And of course, they would present the very best numbers that they could, and we get all excited and think, oh, yeah, I could, you know, that looks like a good one. I should buy that one. But the interesting thing was, you know, so we were new investment advisors, generally with not a lot of clients, you know, in my case, zero, as many people started out that way. And so if you were to get a $100,000 client, that was a big deal in mm-hmm. those days. This was 1996. That would be a big deal. But I remember going for lunch near the end of the program with the people that were running the training program and saying, look, you know, we've seen great stock, you know, ideas from the research team, you know, but realistically, like, how much money does somebody need to have before you can really invest in stocks and get a well-diversified portfolio? Mm-hmm. And the answer was, well, probably something in the order of $250,000. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's like, well, $250,000? I mean, who's going to get an account with $250,000? You know, it was a lot back then.
Yeah.
You know, and so, well, what if they don't have enough money to buy, you know, if they don't have $250,000? Well, then you should probably buy mutual funds, you know, which you're getting the built-in diversification of a fund. You know, and buy some bonds, you know, either through a fund or buy them directly. In those days, we bought bonds a lot, individual bonds. And so from a product standpoint, we had a fairly, I mean, it was a relatively robust stable of, you know, Canadian stocks, some U.S. stocks that we would get some research coverage of U.S. stocks, mutual funds. And these were all Canadian issued mutual funds, even if they were, you know, invested globally, invested in the U.S. or international markets, and a good selection of individual bonds that you could buy, you know, through the bond desk. And in those days, buying bonds, you know, interest rates on a 10-year bond were about 6.8% I remember buying a 10-year BC government strip bond at 6.8% and apologizing to the client because it seemed low. So
can you imagine buying a 6.8% strip bond?
Wouldn't that be something?
Provincially issued now.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something?
Yeah.
So as a result, most of the clients that we started out dealing with, we would buy mutual funds, both Canadian and international funds, and strip bonds. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there were actually limitations on how much foreign content you could hold inside an RRSP. And so the majority of, you know, of our initial, you know, of my initial client base, the funds were typically RRSPs. And so, you know, only 30%, I believe, of the account could be foreign content. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so we would have portfolios that were in mutual funds and, you know, 70% Canadian, 30%, you know, global, mainly US, but US and international. And then strip bonds to make up the appropriate asset mix for the clients. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the funny thing is, I can look back and we can talk about, there was a few things wrong in those days with those portfolios. But from the standpoint of diversification, they actually achieved their goals pretty well. Mm-hmm. You know, from the standpoint of having mutual funds, which have a lot of built-in diversification. And even if they're, you know, what we would call concentrated funds, where they might only have 60 or 70 stock positions, that was a whole lot better than, you know, than buying a single stock or maybe half a dozen stocks. Mm-hmm. So the portfolios actually were, for those days, they were not bad. Also at that time, I believe it was 1990, the Canadian Exchange introduced TIPS, which were the first index ETFs basically to trade in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so that was the Toronto Index Participation Securities. And basically, the TIPS, it was basically a passive investment in the 35 companies that made up the TSE 35 index at the time.
Right. And so there's TIPS and there's HIPS.
And there was HIPS because in those days, there was two indexes, the TSE 35, which is a very concentrated list of, you know, the biggest companies in Canada, and then the TSE 100, mm-hmm. which was a broader group of companies and, you know, and went down the size chain a little bit, you know, but as we'll talk about, the interesting thing about TIPS and HIPS in Canada is they kind of, you know, ran smack into the issue of compensation structure.
Yeah. So right? I was going to ask you about that because What role did like commissions and embedded commissions play in those product selections back in 1996?
It was definitely a consideration, and I'll tell you why. So in those days, most mutual funds were bought on what was called a deferred sales charge structure, where the client theoretically didn't pay anything to buy the fund. The advisor earned a 5% commission from the fund company. And what it resulted in was the client being essentially locked in to that fund family. So they didn't have to keep the same fund, whether it was a Templeton or a Fidelity, you name it. They all had the same structure. And so if they were to sell out of that fund and not switch into another fund within the same family, there might be a sales charge at the back end on the sales, you know. And so if they sold out, let's say after 1 year, there might be a 3.5% charge to the client's account for that early redemption. Mm-hmm. And so there was a good incentive for advisors, a 5% commission up front, a bit of a disincentive for clients or investors to actually move out of that fund company.
Yeah.
And so, so that was the situation. So advisors also had the option to charge what's called an initial sales charge. Mm-hmm. So let's say you bought a mutual fund, if you didn't buy it on a deferred basis, they could charge up to 2%, which the client would pay, but then the client would be free to sell out of the fund at any time.
Yeah.
From an advisor's standpoint, there was really more incentive to sell the deferred sales charge, because they could tell the client, look, you're not paying, and as long as you don't sell entirely out of the fund company within 6 years, mm-hmm. it won't cost you anything. And the advisor would still get the 5% up front, and then they would still get a trailing fee mm-hmm. or a service fee.
But that's bunk. Say you're not paying anything.
Of course.
But the commission's 5%, of course it's coming from somewhere. It's coming returns, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I would say it wasn't the glory days of maybe avoiding conflict of interest, mm-hmm. between an advisor and a client. But the other thing, and when we talked about the index, the index funds, is, indexing, we've talked about this on many podcasts in the past, indexing became popularized in the 70s mm-hmm. based on work done by Eugene Fama and, the efficient market hypothesis that he developed doing his graduate studies, which basically said that because market prices, generally reflect, the absolute, true value of securities at any point in time, then just buying a passive index based on the, or a passive group of securities based on the index, mm-hmm. Is a perfectly valid way of investing. And Jack Bogle of Vanguard Funds took that and introduced the first, available to investor index fund back in the 70s, 76 or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, in Canada, so they came up with an exchange traded fund, which means you could just buy or sell it like a regular stock. But by buying the tips or the hips, you got all of the 35 or 100 stocks that made up the index. The problem is that in those days, compensation for stock transactions were commissions.
Yeah.
So
you pay to play.
So you pay to play, So for an advisor to buy an index fund, which theoretically you could hold forever, you really don't need to sell it, that would be one transaction, and then they would never do another transaction. And so there was a disincentive mm-hmm. in those days, because we didn't have the fee-based accounts that are available now. In those days, there was a disincentive to actually buy things like index units on the, that traded on the exchange. Mm-hmm. Now, index mutual funds were different, because then you could buy them on the same basis that you would buy a regular mutual fund. So the product selection was okay and getting better all the time with the introduction of index ETFs and index mutual funds. And while, as I say, the diversification really, helped out, a lot, again, there were still disincentives. And part of it is because the overall costs of owning mutual funds were very high.
Yeah.
In those days, management expense ratio is getting close to 3%, mm-hmm. which means every year the fund is taking 3% of the value of the fund and using it for paying commissions, paying marketing costs, administration, all that kind of thing. And so,
well, which means that fund has to outperform the benchmark by 3% per year just to get the benchmark returns.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there was a very high hurdle. So for diversification, pretty good. For cost, not so good.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit. Let's change direction a little bit here. Okay. That was a lot of product stuff
and background.
We can talk about the evolution of stocks to mutual funds to ETFs,
sure,
to liquid alts now, yep, all kinds of other things. But what about the client experience? What was expected of an advisor in terms of service and planning in the late 90s versus now?
Well, in the late 90s, it was very transactional, meaning that, you know, we did, you know, there was a know your client rule. We had to know your client, but certainly not with the kind of depth that we do these days. So you'd have to know kind of where they worked, what their net worth was, what their income was, how many kids in the family, things like that. But it was pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And so to open an account, you had to have that basic information. Although in all fairness, the first couple of years or a few years that I was in the business, clients didn't even need to sign the Know Your Client form. So it was kind of something that had to be done, but not taken remarkably seriously.
Yeah.
From a contact standpoint, really, because the business was quite transactional, clients didn't expect much and advisors didn't provide much. So you would call a client if there was a transaction that needed to be made. If it was a client that was basically in more passively managed mutual funds and strip bonds, you might meet once a year, you know, just to review the portfolio, review what's going on in the world, and make sure that nothing significant had changed. But it was really, the emphasis was really more on the transactional side of the business and not so much on the truly developing an understanding, you know, and creating what we call, a plan.
Yeah, so when did that change? When did the emphasis on financial planning become prevalent?
You know, when I started, there were simple financial planning software tools available. So,
like a calculator?
Pretty much. It was different than that, and they would spit out some nice graphs and charts and things, mm-hmm, but it was pretty fundamental and basic in terms of, okay, what does the client have? What are they trying to achieve? And it would spit out a projection. And it was very, very simplistic. And I wouldn't say it was horrible, because it was kind of the best thing we had at the time, but it didn't take into effect issues of, well, what if I want to buy a car every 7 years in the future? What if I want to do some traveling? Mm-hmm. So it was really more, here's what I have now, here's what I'm saving, what will I have in the future? So, mm-hmm, as you say, these days you can certainly do that on a calculator.
Yeah.
And the change obviously has been significant, because where planning in those days, it was really just more of a way to say, okay, well, we need to save more, or we need to achieve a 7 or 8% return, you know, on your investments in order to get you the number that you'd like at the end. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's much more focused on everything from your family structure, mm-hmm, lifestyle, mm-hmm, you know, planned retirement, lifestyle during retirement, planning for your estate, for, yeah, your children's future, for their education. I mean, our ESPs were not around when I started. And so all of that kind of thing became much more important. And as we know now, you know, the largest piece of the puzzle, you know, trying to figure out, okay, well, what is it exactly that we're trying to achieve? What do we need?
Yeah.
You know, and what are we trying to achieve, and can we get there or not? And so it's now it's the plan which basically drives the investment structure. And in the early days, it was really just the investments,
yeah,
driven by a desire to get good returns.
So so what we would say today is that's putting the cart before the horse.
Absolutely.
But back then, that's the way it was, right? Well,
that's the way it was. And in all fairness, it's what was expected kind of on both sides of the table.
Yeah.
You know, investors did not expect, you know, a full financial plan with, you know, looking at their, you know, their estate goals and things like that. What they expected was to be given recommendations, whether stock or mutual funds, so they could get a good return.
I think what they expected was that people like you had access to some secret information.
Yeah.
And you would be able to tell them which stock to buy and, mm-hmm, when.
Yeah.
And that's what they were looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. And working for a large firm with lots of research resources. Yeah. We were able to provide that. But again, we had to, you know, and even as a rookie advisor, we had to, you know, understand that, you know, some of the basic rules of diversification. Now, in those days, we thought if you had 35 stocks, you were diversified, which seemed like a lot.
Yeah.
For many people that own stocks, they might only own, you know, 8 or 10.
Yeah.
And so in those days, 35 was considered a well-diversified portfolio. We know that now is not the case.
It's ridiculous. You know, there's still people in our chairs that still pitch these 20 stock portfolios.
Yep. Yeah.
And I would just say those people just have not caught on to something called evolution.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you think about, you just mentioned the different, not even products, but planning pieces.
Yep.
So when you started your career, RSPs were around, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were.
But you didn't have RESPs?
No.
No RDSPs, I'm assuming?
No. No TFSAs?
TFSAs, nope. And even now FHSA.
Nope.
So I got to tell you, so yesterday I had lunch with my cousin. I don't know him particularly well, and I'm getting to know him. And he said to me, I just feel so overwhelmed with your world. I just feel like I don't know where to even start.
Yeah.
And so you think about the 30 years you've put into that chair.
Yeah.
You know, it makes sense that somebody that doesn't have that experience would feel overwhelmed.
For sure.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny because I have the discussion with my own kids, you know, who are not kids, they're young adults. But, you know, I had with my son, we were talking about RSPs and TFSAs and first home savings accounts. And he was asking, well, you know, I don't save a lot of money, but if I do save some, where should it go?
Yeah.
You know, and we had quite a discussion around it because, you know, he is working and so he does pay taxes. So an RSP obviously would provide some tax relief and savings for the future. A tax-free savings account makes a lot of sense because while you don't get a tax break for making the contributions, the money grows tax-free forever.
Yep.
And the first home savings account, where you get the tax break of making a contribution, and it, you know, and that money can be used to buy your first home, and if not, it can be rolled into an RSP, which is where he figured out the money should go. Which I totally agree that he made the right choice.
Right.
But yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
You know, and so for people that aren't, you know, blessed with either a wealthy parents or whatever that have to consider, where does my money go? Where do I, you know, any money I save, where do I put it first?
Yeah.
You know, these are very complicated, you know, discussions.
Yeah, for sure. And I was actually reading last night about something called money dysmorphia.
Oh, yeah.
Which a lot of people have like body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you're looking at one.
Well, we won't get into that, Greg. I think you're looking great, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Oh, stop it.
Okay, actually, before we go down that path, you know what? Maybe what we'll do is I'm going to give you one more question and then we're going to wrap up today's.
Right.
So the last question I have for you today is just talking about this shift from the product-centric conversations around which stock to buy, which strip bond, which deferred sales charge mutual fund to ETFs, whatever. So this shift from that product-specific discussion to goals-based or values-based planning.
Yep.
Can you just comment on that?
Well, yeah, and I think it's what I said earlier is like over time, you know, well, let me back up a bit. The evolution of product and service kind of drove the change that, you know, that we talked about, because we didn't really close the loop on product. You know, I explained what it was like back then. And for people that may not be as familiar, they certainly will be if they've talked to you. But obviously we know for a fact that the high management fees of mutual funds from those days were unsustainable, and that people were not, you couldn't ask a fund manager to beat the index by 3% consistently in order to cover the fees. And so as a result, what we've seen are our mutual fund, you know, expense ratios come way down.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, you know, if management fees are 1.25% or something, I mean, that's probably okay. It's certainly better than 3%. Could they be lower? Yeah. And there are ways to lower them by, you know, by product selection, but.
Well, and they're trending down all the time.
That's right. So management fees have come down. Compensation for advisors has changed dramatically. There is no such thing as a deferred sales charge anymore. They're not allowed in Canada. And many advisors don't operate on a transactional basis at all. So whether or not you buy an exchange traded fund, like they don't, tips and hips aren't around anymore. But it's not really based on commission. Like trading is not prevalent, you know, as a way to, you know, to invest or to generate revenue for advisors. So we can talk more about that in a subsequent one. The shift to the client focused, planning focused approach was really, it took a while. And I would say, in my experience, and you and I have worked together during the biggest part of this change, I would say following the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, I would say that changed a lot for people. And it's not that the trends weren't there. Financial planning has been around for a long time, and financial planners have always existed, operating in many cases separately from investment advisors. So there are fee-only financial planners that would put together a plan for you, but then send you to an investment advisor to invest your funds mm-hmm. based on the plan. But I would say that there was a dramatic shift that happened, certainly for us, but I think in the industry as well, back in after the global financial crisis, when people realized, well, wait a second, things aren't guaranteed. Stock market went mm-hmm. down by half. Mm-hmm. You know, so anybody that was entirely in stocks lost half their wealth. Even bond, you know, if you had
that's
a nice,
if they owned the index.
If they owned the index, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah,
and or if you even if you had a well diversified portfolio, you might easily have gone down 20%. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of shook a lot of individual investors, but as well as advisors and firms, into saying, well, wait a sec, maybe this focus on product is wrong. Maybe if we start with a view of, well, what is it that people need? Mm-hmm. You know, what are they trying to accomplish and what do they need from an investment standpoint to get there? Mm-hmm. Then maybe we can come up with something that will get them there without exposing them to all the risks that we know, mm-hmm. you know, are out there when it comes to stock market investing, let's say, or even bond market investing. But, you know, you try to pretend it's a rare event. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's a rare event. Everything's a 1 in 100, you know, year possibility until it happens.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's a guaranteed event.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, I think, you know, and certainly in the industry, but also in our own business, that really was a turning point. Mm-hmm. You know, and we embraced a new way of dealing with clients from a service standpoint. And the investment side of things really forced us to look at, well, what are the best ways to invest? So mm-hmm. let's agree that some of the old ways don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I would say the global financial crisis really sped up the process of looking at investing as more than just buying stocks and bonds.
Yeah.
And really more of a wealth management approach. And it wasn't just us, but there were a whole lot of people that maybe didn't get the message that we did. I mean, what about you though? I mean, you started not that long after me, and you were in the financial services business, mm-hmm. you know, before getting into the investment side. When did it happen for you? Like, do you feel the kind of the way I did about the
definitely the global GFC? Financial crisis? Yeah. Definitely. Prior to that, you know, I feel like my job was to source stock ideas
yep.
for clients that paid us for those services. Mm-hmm. But when that goes away, like, and you realize, wait a minute, I don't really know what stock to buy.
Yeah.
But not only do I not know, but Greg doesn't know, and the other people beside us don't know. And then you start spending time with analysts and you realize very quickly, well, they don't really know. They just have models, right?
Yes, for sure.
And then you start questioning all of it, right?
Yep.
Like, well, why are there these guided portfolios or guided recommended lists put out by these big firms? And how does that relate to their own investment banking arms in them trying to secure underwriting of the companies that they're giving, you know, high ratings to.
Yeah.
You start to question it all.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, you and I were fortunate in one way that we went through the global financial crisis and we got to revisit what works and what doesn't work.
Yep.
And we came up with an investment solution that in 2009 that we still follow today.
Exactly.
And it works.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to dig into that another time.
For sure.
But at the same time, we also were introduced to some more robust planning.
Yeah.
And the way I look at it now, it's like, it's kind of like if you went to your doctor, right? And you didn't do a single test or anything. Mm-hmm. And they just prescribed some drug to you.
Yeah.
And maybe the doctor's prescribing that drug because there's a kickback.
Yeah.
It's kind of the way it was back in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Like, don't call it a kickback,
but call it
an embedded commission.
Right? Yeah, and I think, you know, I think in all fairness, I mean, that was the way the world worked then.
Yes.
You know, and
but people also could smoke on airplanes back then.
That's right.
I mean, things changed.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, and I think that evolution, well, for us, it was more of a revolution that happened in 2007, 2009, because I know for me personally, I said, like, I don't want to own things in my portfolio that could go to zero.
Yeah.
I don't want zeros in the portfolio anymore. Mm-hmm. And there were plenty of them if you owned individual stocks, and everyone's heard lots of examples of those things happening, but you should never own something that could go to zero.
Not everybody has, though. The younger generation, and I don't want to sound like an old man here, but they have not felt that pain.
Right.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, what have they grown up with now? Meme stocks, yeah. Right? Crypto, you know, diamond hands versus paper hands, all yeah. that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm actually meeting with somebody today. He's a first-year finance student. And the reason I'm meeting with him is I met him a while ago, and he talked to me about how he was buying deep out-of-the-money call options on a specific stock.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, what do you know about
right.
what you're getting into?
Yeah.
And then he was talking about doing, you know, using it through, like, leverage.
Ah.
It's like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and sure, and there was lots of bravado in investing when I started. Mm-hmm. And there's probably still lots of bravado. And people, it took a long time for someone to go through a really jarring economic event mm-hmm. like the global financial crisis. That was really the first one like that since 1973-74. You know, because the various...
What about long-term capital management,
maybe? That's right, but it didn't affect most people. Right. Yeah, the stock market took a 20% hit or something, and then it recovered, you know, quickly. Even the tech bubble bursting, you know, if you weren't heavily, heavily invested in tech stocks, you probably came out of that not too badly.
Yeah.
You know, and the markets went down a lot, you know, but in with a balanced portfolio, you probably came out okay.
Yeah.
You know, 1987, you know, that was, you know, Black Monday. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't an economic event that drove that. Mm-hmm. It was like the bursting of, you know, of some bubbles because stocks had done extremely well. But yeah, so for a lot of people, if you haven't lived through the global financial crisis, or maybe our parents that lived through the 73-74 economic mm-hmm. crisis, you don't really feel it. Mm-hmm. And we've always said many times on this podcast, like if it's all academic, mm-hmm. you know, you can't feel the pain until you look at your statement and you see it's down, you know, you've lost half your money. And then the feeling is pretty bad. So,
yeah.
But listen, you know, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to carry on this conversation.
Yeah, so that's, I'd propose we just pick it up because, yeah, we can't, you know, can't bore people to death here by going on and on.
Okay, well, then just stop.
Fine, stop. You stop.
All right. Okay, well, thank you, and we'll pick this up soon.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, and exempt market dealer. Canvas Wealth is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy cannot be guaranteed and is subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals and do not represent the opinion of Q Wealth as a firm.